Mass shootings are good for gun sales. In the days following the horrific school massacre in Texas, firearm stocks rose. Gun buyers, conditioned to fear new restrictions, tend to run out and buy more weapons after shootings like this one. They seem to believe that lawmakers will respond to mass shootings by making it harder to buy a gun. After all, when other consumer products are found to be a danger to humans, they are regulated. Last year, the federal government recalled 40,000 units from a line of children's bunk beds whose defective ladder killed a 2-year-old in Ohio. And the U.S. Public Interest Research Group offers a lengthy list of toys the U.S. government has recalled because of choking hazards. It makes sense to regulate harmful products, especially where children's health and safety are concerned. But thousands of children are victims of gun violence each year, yet weapons of war remain easily available for purchase. The Ovald shooter bought two AR-15-style rifles legally from a federally licensed gun store just days before the massacre and used one of them to end 21 lives. After Ovald, a group of pediatricians published a plea for gun control in Scientific American. The doctors pointed out that gun violence is now the leading cause of death among people aged 1 to 19. The politicization of guns, they wrote, is taking priority over public health. How else to explain the endless proliferation of killing machines when we won't even tolerate a faulty ladder? Many factors drive this politicization. For one thing, gun sales are big business. Some manufacturers with federal contracts even use their profits to lobby against gun control. For another, the National Rifle Association holds great sway in Washington and drives large campaign donations to GOP politicians to ensure inaction. But at heart, this is a cultural problem. Hollywood, for example, glamorizes guns the way it once did smoking. Researchers Brad Bushman and Dan Romer found that acts of gun violence in PG-13 movies nearly tripled between 1985 and 2015. But even more dangerously, guns have become central to the right-wing's culture wars. They have become synonymous with a perverse understanding of freedom and defense, a word that appears in the name of the manufacturer Daniel Defense, whose rifle was used to kill children in Ovald. Defense for whom? Violent crime and property crime rates nationwide have dramatically fallen since the 1990s. Studies show that guns are extremely rarely used in self-defense. They are much more often involved in assaults, homicides, suicides, or accidental discharges. This is a charade, says Tufts public health professor Michael Siegel of the Self-Defense Trope. Instead, the freedom to defend oneself has become a powerful cultural idea for a shrinking white population whose paranoia is being stoked incessantly by Fox News, the Republican Party, and gun manufacturers. In one commercial, Daniel Defense founder Marty Daniel narrates, "There are two types of people in the world, good people and evil people. And just in case evil people get in charge, good people need to have the ability to fight back." Siegel says this is a racialized fear. The far-right's mostly white male gun owners are so convinced of this imagined threat from evil others that some openly speculated that Ovald shooter must have been an illegal alien or a woman. He was neither. A majority of Americans support gun restrictions, but the GOP gerrymanders districts and relies on the undemocratic Senate and Supreme Court to keep this paranoid minority in power. And as a result, their hate-filled fantasies have made it all but impossible to regulate the leading cause of children's death. Eventually, the pro-gun control majority must ask, how long will we pay for this system with the lives of our children?
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, the spring of noble emotions. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Have you ever seen how a house is built or a building? It's constructed. It's built out of bricks and stones. So where normally a person want to make a shelter for himself, he builds a home, a shelter, a building out of stone and bricks. And we know about them, that they are pieces of matter, firm, rigid, inflexible pieces of matter that cannot stick to one another. So if you put a bunch of stones upon one another, they will not stick to one another. But they will fall away. It will be a dangerous place to be near them. So how we built a home, how we built a house, how we built a shelter for ourselves, we built it by putting those stones on one another, but not just the stones, because they are firm enough. They are firm enough to and strong enough to build a home, but they do not stick to one another. They cannot create a bond with one another. And to build a home, to build a house, to build a building, a shelter, you don't just need a pieces of strong matter that cannot stick to one another. You need something to create a bond, to create a relation between those pieces of bricks and stones. And what is that thing? That is the what is called the mortar, that gentle and that delicate paste which you put between the bricks, and it creates a bond and relation between those things. So without that adhesive paste which can create a bond and relation between bricks and stones, you cannot build a home. Together by bricks and stones and with the adhesive paste which can create a bond between those stiff, inflexible pieces of matter that you make a home for yourself. You made a shelter for yourself. Scholars say that likewise, if you want to create a family, if you want to create a society with family, with sound family relations, we humans are also like stones and bricks. We have our own personal interests. We have our own autonomous interests. So we cannot create a bond to one another. We see that we are in a kind of competition to one another, in a kind of a race, in a kind of competition which makes us detached from one another. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z. We were talking about the human relations and how result of our own desires and personal interests, how we are detached from one another and how our personal interests make us vulnerable to not be attracted and not create a bond with our human fellows. So what's that power? What's that thing that creates a bond with another and make a society and a family a powerful unit? It's the emotions. It's the noble human emotions. There's like the paste that it has you paste that links the humans with one another. And one of the personalities and one of the human relations, which is the spring and source of human noble emotion, is the mother. Yes, she is the spring of noble human emotions. She's the one who sticks the family together. She's the one who has the power, who has the blessing that holds the family together. So mother is a gift from Allah. She is the gesture and she is the manifestation of divine love and divine care. So you can see in your society, in your family, that who is the most powerful binding force in your family, and you'll find that she is your mother. So she's a gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you have that gift in your life, please take care of it. Please feel like you have a great gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And take care of her. Don't never ever hurt her. And if you lost this gift and she's not more with you, please pray for her. Praying for her will bring blessing to your life. And never forget that her having her in life is a great gift. It's a source of divine blessing for us. And we all know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings his blessings and his mercy to us through sources, through different occasions. And mother is such a gift that she's a source of divine blessing for us. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he give us the tawfiq and he may give us the will to take care of our mothers and to help us and to take care of us in a good way that will be the pleasing for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Secretary General of the Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the resistance would not remain silent in the face of the Israeli regime's efforts to plunder the country's maritime gas resources. Syed Hassan Nasrallah made the remark on Thursday after a vessel operated by a Greek company arrived at the Karish gas field in Lebanon's territorial waters to extract gas for the occupying regime. Nasrallah noted the enemy does not recognize the international law and resolutions, reminding that it was not the international regulations, but actually pressure, war of attrition, and resistance that forced the occupying enemy to retreat from the southern Lebanon and the Palestinian enclave of the Gaza Strip.
Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. They have MPs inside. and you know, they can somehow manage to you know, maybe adopt a resolution inside the parliament and then move forward with maybe attacking the Israeli vessels and you know, their workers or so on, you know, to push them away from their resources and their land.
Hezbollah chief also said that the U.S. and Israel are seeking to afflict Lebanon with hunger and partition. Nasrallah said the Lebanese companies that have pioneered to extract the maritime area's resources have been threatened by the U.S. and Israel, warning that Washington and Tel Aviv were after shaving off a large part of the resource-rich area. Lebanon and Israel took part in indirect talks to discuss maritime demarcation in 2020, but they stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, where Israel has given exploration rights to a Greek firm. The talks were supposed to discuss the Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area, according to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers more further south, including part of Karish. Israel relies heavily on gas and has long been developing a number of illegal offshore gas deposits in the Mediterranean Sea. This is a particularly sensitive issue for Lebanon, which is dealing with fuel shortages amid a worsening economic crisis.
And I'm pretty sure Hezbollah is wise enough to do this with coordination with other political parties inside Lebanon. You know, Hezbollah does not want to control the country and does not want to push the country towards war, but they want to secure their sovereignty, they want to secure their resources, and they want to keep the country a safe country. And Hezbollah has been proven, you know, with all these years, all their sacrifices and their actions. You know, they're a very credible organization inside Lebanon and a political party that has a lot of good allies. And I think that this is a great opportunity, hopefully, to be able to get some more financial support for the Lebanese nation.
Hezbollah says it has the material and military capabilities that enable it to prevent Israel's gas extraction from Karish. The Hezbollah Secretary General has cautioned the Israeli regime against seeking another war on Lebanon, saying the regime's losses would be greater than those of Lebanon in the event of such military confrontation. This is not the first time the regime has sought to encroach on a nation's sovereign territory, but this time, the response it would receive could be unprecedented.
The U.S. and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN nuclear watchdog's 35-nation board of governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as Tehran's failure to answer questions on alleged uranium traces at undeclared sites. It also accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The resolution excludes a recommendation to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council, a move that would significantly escalate tensions and likely sink the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 agreement. The resolution against Iran is said to have stemmed from information within two quarterly reports on the country's nuclear activities that were circulated amongst board members last week. Iran insisted it had declared all sites which hosted past nuclear activities. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, said Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites.
One of the main things to understand here is that the IAEA as an institution is meant to be, exactly as you said, a technical one. But now it is being used as a vehicle for political purposes in order to pressure Iran, in order to continue the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration wanted with the support of Israel to isolate Iran.
These fake documents seek to maintain maximum pressure on Iran The Israeli regime has openly called on the nuclear watchdog to censure Iran's nuclear program. In brazen remarks to the Knesset, the regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Israel expected the IAEA's Board of Governors to strongly condemn Iran and make sure it will pay a heavy price.
So what we are seeing now is a campaign led by the United States, by Israel, and by European partners who promised that they would uphold the JCPOA and respect Iran and respect the deal and want to push America back into the deal. They are now turning around at the Board of Governors of the IAEA and pursuing this really regrettable, unfortunate, and downright dishonorable policy.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA, and I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the U.S. and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war with Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty, and it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the U.S. and its allies France, Britain and Germany for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The U.S., however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
Since July 2015, when the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action came into existence, Iran's nuclear program has been open to inspections described as unprecedented in the history of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Under that agreement, Tehran voluntarily agreed to grant international inspectors easy access to its atomic sites well beyond its IAEA obligations. The agency was also allowed to install many more surveillance cameras at Iranian sites. The IAEA's inspections in Iran account for over a quarter of all agencies' monitoring activity around the world. Despite the close cooperation, the International Atomic Energy Agency is once again accusing Iran of failing to cooperate. This week, the IAEA's Board of Governors passed a resolution critical of Iran. The resolution was sponsored by the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. The agency says it is not satisfied with the answers Iran has provided to its probes of three sites. The resolution has been described as a blow to the stalled talks between Iran and the P4+1 group to revive the moribund 2015 deal. The IAEA resolution criticizing Iran was passed amid an intensified Israeli lobbying campaign to derail diplomacy with Iran. Israel is a sworn enemy of the hard-earned 2015 deal and makes no secret of its efforts to destroy it completely. The IAEA's Board of Governors passed its latest resolution just days after IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi visited Israel. Iran is also highly critical of the IAEA for failing to even raise the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons program during Grossi's recent visit. The atomic agency's credibility and impartiality are on the line as it seems to be yielding to pressure by nuclear-armed Israel to mount pressure on Iran.
But I do agree that Iran has good reason to be angry with the resolution because it is an extension of the one rule for us and a different rule for you approach that's been taken by the IAEA with respect to Iran from the beginning of this entire issue. Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology. Iran has complied with inspections. And what appears to be the case here is that Israel and the United States are together attempting to restrict Iran's development as a nuclear power.
After years of unprecedented inspections in its nuclear sites, the Iranian government seems to be outraged by the IAEA censure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi pledged that such measures will never force Iran to back down from its rights. Meanwhile, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, says it is unfortunate that the IAEA is being exploited by an illegitimate regime. He demanded the agency put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. As tensions between Iran and the agency soared this week, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that it is disconnecting over 24 surveillance cameras that were installed in Iran beyond the country's IAEA obligations. Iran is also installing 2 new cascades of the IR-6 advanced centrifuges at its Natanz atomic fuel production facility. The Iranian atomic chief has said that Iran provided accurate answers to IAEA questions, but the agency lacks the will to declare Iran's answers convincing. Iran argues that the IAEA's focus on the country is discriminatory because it accounts for only a small amount of global nuclear activity and is undergoing hundreds of inspections per year. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 have held a year of intense negotiations to try to find a way to restore the JCPOA, but talks have stalled since March. The latest episode between Iran and the IAEA could further complicate the negotiations. Observers believe that the IAEA is pushing things in the direction favored by Israel.
Well, I believe that the resolution, which is primarily aimed at disrupting Iran's nuclear development program, is just part of a broader program of regional hegemony on the part of Israel. This program of regional hegemony has been supported by the United States in the past, and in fact, Israel was a prime mover in having the United States invade Iraq on the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction. I'm deeply concerned, and I must say I'm far more concerned than the IAEA could be about Iran's nuclear development program. I am much more concerned than that about the potential for Israel developing this issue via its supporters in the United States and via its own Israel lobby in America to bring the entire region into a potential state of war.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia, alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. And Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now that establish beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of the Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Allahumma faqbal udhri warham shiddat dhurri wa fukkani min shidd wa thaqi ya rabbi irham dha'fa badani wa
Dear listeners, we were discussing this excerpt of the Kumail supplication. Allahumma faqbal udhri warham shiddata dhurri. O Allah, so accept my excuse, have mercy upon the severity of my affliction. Ya Rabbi irham dha'fa badani wa riqqata jildi wa diqqata 'azmi. O Allah, have mercy upon the weakness of my body, on the thinness of my skin, and the frailty of my bones. O you who raised in my creation, to the remembrance of me, to the nurture of me, to the goodness toward me, and to the nourishment of me. Ya man bada'a khalqi wa dhikri wa tarbiyati wa birri wa taghdiyati. Habni libtida'i karamik wa salifi birrukabi. Bestow upon me for the sake of your having given rise to me with generosity and your previous goodness to me. This kind of asking from the servant, from the supplicant, is coming right after when Imam Ali alayhi salam said, وَقَدْ أَتَيْتُكَ يَا إِلَهِ بَعْدَ تَقْسِيرِي. O Allah, I confess to my shortcoming. I confess to my immoderation toward myself. And I am preferring my excuse. I am regretful, I am broken, and I'm apologizing. It looks somehow that Imam Ali alayhi salam is teaching us to be aware of these etiquettes and prerequisites of supplication. First, you need to return to your Lord with your heart, mu'tarifa. You need to be apologizing, you need to be acknowledging, and you need to be confessing. It is only then that we can start asking what we need. You need to first have a kind of perception of your own poverty, because it denotes a level among the levels of realization of your neediness toward Allah. The more your awareness of your need toward Allah, the closer would be your prayer to acceptance. The nearer you would be toward Almighty Allah's mercy. And this is merely because there is no such thing as miserliness in the mercy of Allah. The difference among the people in receiving the mercy of Allah is solely due to the difference in the receptacle of their souls and their capacity. And we have it even in our traditions that Allah the Exalted gives everyone according to his own capacity. Everyone procures Allah's mercy according to the wideness of his receptacle, according to the somehow volume of his container. The greater the receptacle, the greater one's share will be from the mercy of Allah. So, based on what we said, we can summarize the reality of prayer and dua, specifically in the supplication of Kumail, as realizing need and faqr, and second, presentation of that need and faqr before Allah. First, you need to perceive that you are poor, that you are indigent, and then you need to present that need before the Almighty Allah. It is then that you can start asking Him truly from the depth of your heart.
Oh Allah, accept my apology and have pity on my intense sufferings and set me free from my heavy fetters. My nourisher, have mercy on the weakness of my body, the delicacy of my skin and the brittleness of my bones. O He who originated my creation and accorded me my individuality and ensured my upbringing and welfare and provided my sustenance, I beg you to restore your favors and blessings upon me as you did in the beginning of my life.
Thank you, Allah. So good about all the things that we went. it's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of Dua.
So the supplicant, after mentioning all those states, inner states of himself, after recognizing his own destitution and his state, he says, يَا رَبِّ ارْحَمْ ضَعْفَ بَدَنِي وَرِقَّةَ جِلْدِي وَدِقَّةَ عَذْمِي. O Allah, have mercy upon the weakness of my body, on the thinness of my skin, and on the frailty of my bones. Imam Ali alayhi salam is teaching us that there are different stages if you want to complete the reality of prayer. If you want to realize the reality of prayer, first you need to be aware of your own indigence, and then you need to present it before Allah. It is worthy of note here that the need and faqr, from the philosophical point of view, is not only restricted to the need and dependency in the coming into existence. Rather, it implies the need both in the coming into existence as well as the continuity of the existence, or the so-called huduth and baqa. And this can easily be realized by having a look at all the requests of Imam Ali alayhi salam mentioned in this divine supplication. To elaborate on this, we can say this is exactly the way the light produced from electricity is in constant need of the flow of electrons. The lantern, for example, will give light so long as there is a constant flow of electrons, such that there would be an immediate break in the brightness if the flow were to be caught even for a moment. And man's neediness and dependency on Allah is exactly such. He comes into existence while he is poor, while he is indigent, and he is dependent. And his existence, his talents, his movements, his life are all connected to Allah, and they are all in need of him moment after moment, continuously and constantly. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be the most close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Five young and rare Bonelli's eagles born on a breeding farm in France are taking a journey to Spain, where they will be released into the wild. These eaglets were born in captivity, which is a rare feat for this endangered species. Three of the five are ready to be released. and have been fitted with GPS microchips for tracking purposes. Their initial release date was delayed because of several weeks of bird flu, which made traveling impossible. The other two eagles are too young to be reintroduced and are still being hand-fed from behind the curtain. They will make the journey sometime in July. The breeders, however, are worried about how to sustain the program as their birds begin to age.
The Bonelli's eagle is a species that is relatively scarce. In France, we must have about 40 couples, something like that, who produce about 20 chicks per year. Here, we have 5 chicks, but my birds are very old. Still, 5 chicks is not nothing for a species which relies on a small reproduction number.
Pacto also says his 5 pairs of eagles are aged between 18 and 30 years, and 3 of them are now too old to breed. He says the number of Bonelli's eagles had dropped dramatically since the 1980s, mainly to electrocution on high-voltage lines. Due to the reintroduction program, the population of these eagles has nearly doubled over the past 2 decades. A Belgian company is trying to combat urban waste by transforming used coffee grounds into edible mushrooms that can also be used in construction. The mycelium is grown in a damp cellar in Brussels. Some 5 tons of coffee grounds are collected each month from partner cafes. They are then mixed in drums where the oyster mushroom spores are added and mixed with straw in a sack. The mushrooms emerge from slashes in the sacks 15 days afterwards and are ready to be sent to shops for sales. The business owners say they are looking to expand their business and use coffee and mushrooms as an environmentally friendly alternative to plastic.
Each day we throw away a lot of coffee, and this coffee to be produced needs a lot of energy from the cultivation to the transportation to Europe, and it's just a pity not to use it more than a few minutes to drink a coffee.
The company has already tested out its fungus-based insulating tiles and received its first order of these tiles for soundproofing purposes. Jacket says they hope to produce 12 tons of the mycelium material per month when they gather enough investment. The business owner says there is no shortage of raw material as coffee is widely consumed in Belgium. Jacket says the innovation can dramatically cut down on plastic waste.
China launches 3 astronauts to its Tiangong space station as its construction enters a critical phase. The 3 blasted off from a launch center in northwestern China. They are the 2nd group of astronauts to head to the space station since its construction began in April 2021. They will stay there for 6 months. The space station is planned as a 3-section structure. The core module was launched in April, and 2 more components will be sent into space in July and September. The new mission will oversee the integration of the 3 parts. The crew's commander has described the task as a pivotal battle in the construction of Tiangong, which is planned to be completed by the end of 2022.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to 2 more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found 2 additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there will be many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warn that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. If the station is established successfully, it will replace the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. It will be the world's highest of its kind, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences.
A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular. The engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff, but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40-millimeter tempered glass. The contemporary ceramics exhibition kicks off at the Villa d'Atres Art Foundation near the French city of Avignon. The exhibit showcases nearly 130 artworks of all sizes. Some are so big they are put on display outdoors. The foundation has created these modern forms from roughly 100 artists from all over the world. The exhibit displays an exceptional diversity of eclectic works presenting sophisticated skills and artistry. Participating artists say working with clay and playing with glazes always produces a unique item that often generates a profoundly universal reaction. The goal of the event is to show how ceramic art has returned to the forefront of the contemporary art scene.
A man in the city of Soran in Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region has become a local celebrity for a rather peculiar feature on his face. Hussein Abdullah Ahmed is famous for a record-breaking length of his mustache. Ahmed has been going by the name Mr. Mustache for decades now. His mustache has reached a length of 2.4 meters, making him a well-known man in the city he hails from. His son says, however, that his father's unusual feature is nothing new for him.
I've always known my father likes this since I was born, although there were times when I had seen his mustache short. My dad is famous for his mustache, and we're proud of him.
Ahmed admits his mustache troubles him while working on the farm or trying to sleep, but to avoid the trouble, he either ties it from behind or stuffs it under his clothes. The 73-year-old man is not planning to get rid of his facial hair, which he hasn't trimmed since 1994. He seems to be enjoying the ride of fame as people stop him on the streets to take selfies with him.
The annual Vivid Life Festival has returned to Sydney after being cancelled 2 years in a row due to the coronavirus pandemic. The event kicked off with fireworks and lighting the sails of the Sydney Opera House. Iconic structures like the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia are part of a series of new canvases this time around. As an added treat, the 2022 festival also has the longest continuous light walk in the history of the event. Plus, this year's highlights include a choreographed light show by 600 drones. Both residents and tourists have been anticipating the return of the show.
I saw it about 8 years ago, I think, and it's just got better and better, as far as I can tell. I mean, the Opera House is the most amazing canvas possible to project, this just amazing digital artwork. The vibrancy of it, the colour of it, the animation of it, the explosiveness of it, the colour just bursts out in just amazing ways. That the snakes, the chameleons, the lizards crawling across it.
The Harbour City will glow with 50 light installations, the deprojection artworks, as well as over 100 musical events. Vivid Sydney is an annual festival that lasts for 23 nights, infusing art, innovation and technology while collaborating with boundary-pushing artists. In 2019, the festival attracted millions of attendees. The event is owned and managed by the Tourism and Major Events Agency of the Government of New South Wales.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.